Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Dr. Sophie for our weekly podcast. Hope you're doing well and your families are doing well. We are on track. Today, we're going to be talking about abuse, stereotypes versus reality. You know, a lot of times I think abuse has a kind of connotation, but not real clarity about what it is. Is it really abusive? Does it cross a line? Is it verbal? Is it emotional? Is it intellectual? Is it sexual? There's all different kinds of abuse. So I think today we would really like to talk about it and really help you get some clarity and understanding so that it's called what it is and it's identified appropriately. Because if we don't identify anything appropriately, you really can't put a solid treatment plan together to make it better. So bottom line is know what you're treating and then you'll get good treatment outcomes. So today we're talking about abuse, stereotypes versus reality. We're going to see who are abusers. What are the effects of abuse? How can we deal with an abuser? Especially if it's a family member or somebody we are connected to by blood and we have no other choice sometimes. And then, of course, the 4 points for you to take away about this podcast. So we're here in the studio, 1-855-SOPHIE-NOW, 1-855-767-4966. Each caller will receive a free signed copy of my book, Side by Side, The Revolutionary Mother-Daughter Program for Conflict-Free Communication. In studio today, we have the well-known substance abuse expert and guru, Brandon. Are you here?
I am here. Were you about to mispronounce my last name?
No, I didn't get you. Brandon Stephan, the well-known. You have a Twitter, right?
I actually at this point in time am still entirely word of mouth.
Well, you should get some social presence.
I am working on it, but should we have Jono set it up right now?
Yeah, for sure.
I have a Twitter and I have an Instagram and have a Facebook, but they're all personal. None of them have anything to do with my calling.
Yes, and that is your calling. You're really good at it.
Thank you, Dr. Sophie. Is this where we exchange pleasantries and compliments?
We don't have to.
I mean, I do that on a fairly regular basis with you anyways when we are with our shared clients and patients.
Yes, we do. But you do a really great job, and your people get better, which is really nice.
It is. It's not great for business, but it is very good for them as human beings.
Well, it is good. It's word of mouth.
It is.
They're lining up.
Word of mouth. They are lining up.
So today we're going to talk about abuse versus like stereotypes versus realities. And I think you see that a lot where people really don't know clearly what it is, where the line is crossed. Is that really abuse? Is that gaslighting? Like, what are we doing?
Well, there are just so many moments where every possible excuse is made, both for the behavior and then also for the rationale or the reasoning or the motivation behind the abuse.
Yep.
And there's just such hesitance to actually term it what it is.
Right.
And call it what it is.
Right. And I think that hesitance is what? What do you think is underneath that?
The word abuse, whether you're talking about substance abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, it carries such weight. And the moment where it transitions from this is an isolated incident or this is just something that happened, we can explain it away to abuse or a pattern of abuse, the stigma on that person, both the abuser and the abused, it's lifelong. It's enormous.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But I also think another part of this is if people identify it as abuse and it really is abuse, then they have to make a decision they're not comfortable with and they want to stay in denial.
Right. The response.
Yeah.
And the longer that you can avoid
dealing with it
and that response,
the better off it is in your mind, but not in reality.
Right. Not in reality at all. And the cause and effect where people are either abusing somebody physically or on the receiving end of physical abuse, where then they are turning to substances and they are abusing substances as a result of the actual physical or emotional abuse.
Right.
It's the overwhelming majority of sexual assaults, of physical assaults, of rape, of murder in the United States occur when one or both parties have consumed alcohol or drugs.
Right.
It's just the numbers. It's anywhere from 60% all the way into the 80%.
Very scary. Very scary. And I guess a lot of the time, the initiation of the substance into the mix is to self-medicate.
Absolutely. The self-medication, and you and I speak about this frequently, but the first thing that a person needs is to see a doctor when they're having any sort of issue.
Right.
Is to see a doctor, get diagnosed and get prescribed, and then actually follow through and take their medication.
Right.
When that is not occurring, when that first crucial step hasn't occurred, and everybody's not going to be diagnosed with something, but you need to at least see someone.
Right.
And get a diagnosis if there is one and get medicated. If that initial step isn't happening, most people are self-medicating somehow.
Yeah.
They're self-medicating inappropriately, and they're self-medicating without any actual idea of what they're doing, what they're putting into their bodies. It might work a little bit.
Yeah, but in the long run, it doesn't.
Right.
I mean, I think people are either some don't know where to go or who to go to, or they think they need help and they'll go to a therapist who doesn't necessarily always see the need for an evaluation by a doctor or a psychiatrist. And then the boat is missed for a little while. But hopefully people will start to see that that's the way to go. Start with a doctor, psychiatrist. It's a confidential relationship. Get on medicine so you're not using street drugs, basically, or medicating yourself. And then that takes a lot of the problem and starts to contain it.
It takes away an enormous amount of the problem. And to get back to something you were saying earlier, the need for the person, the victim, to actually have the strength and the fortitude to come forward and address and admit and say what's happening is the really crucial part.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see, I'm involved in a pretty public divorce with a celebrity who's been terribly abused and still hasn't spoken out, but will. But that's been the biggest struggle, to get a victim to step up and speak out against the perpetrator.
With regards to, because you do have a lot of high profile patients, and I know that your approach as a doctor doesn't vary based upon who your patient is, but all the extraneous, everything else floating around outside.
Those paparazzi cameras.
Right. And around it.
Husbands.
That has to filter into it. And I'm not saying filter into the actual work with the patient, but that has to be such a distraction. It has to be so stressful, not only for your patients, but for you yourself as their healthcare provider.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. You're chasing, you know, you're running from process servers and ex-husband threats and all that. But, you know, if I cave in, then I'm not there for my patient. But yes, it's stressful. But that's part of dealing with it. Role modeling that for the patient is key. So, but yeah, it goes with the territory. And that fear and that intimidation and bullying and emotional abuse is why that victim is so frightened.
When you first came to Los Angeles and were establishing your practice and getting involved in this world, in this very unique ecosystem, let's say your first famous or celebrity or person that you had as a patient, did you think to yourself at some point in time, what am I doing? Why am I getting involved in this world? Why am I taking on or assuming all of these additional burdens and responsibilities that go along with this life and with this world?
Well, I didn't realize what I was doing, to be honest with you. I just was like called to see a patient who ended up being Paris and going to jail. And then after that, you're in it.
Right.
And then if you're there to help people, it just keeps going. And it's word of mouth, just like yours. So I didn't have time to think about it.
Reflecting back, would you have not done anything differently, but would you have girded yourself a little bit differently? Thinking about specifically with Paris, but then also going forward as you've gone through with any number of patients, is there any way to truly prepare yourself for a high-profile patient?
No. Honestly, all you have to do is have basic morals and values that you stick by no matter who the patient is. And you just follow that. And you don't get intimidated by but who's got what and who doesn't have what. It's all the same. You know, they're the issues. It's gaslighting, it's abuse, it's bullying, all that.
Right.
Substance abuse. So joining us on the phone is our guest expert today, Dr. Rhonda Freeman. She's a clinical neuropsychologist licensed in Florida. She earned her PhD in psychology, specializing in neuropsychology from Drexel University in Philadelphia. Dr. Freeman, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you for joining us.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
So we want to continue a conversation we had a little bit before you got on about abuse, stereotypes versus realities. I mean, what are your thoughts about it?
With respect to the stereotypes of abuse?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you all talked about so far, but I know some of the stereotypes I hear is mostly that it's when the person is physically harming the partner and they consider that abuse, but they don't consider the emotional and verbal behaviors of an abuser to be abusive. And so that tends to make people a little unsure if that really is abuse. So I know that's one of the stereotypes I've heard.
That drives me crazy because as the medical director of a child system here in Los Angeles, I mean, how could you not think that berating a child or verbally abusing somebody is abuse?
Mm-hmm, exactly. It's worse, yeah.
Or, you know, a partner or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's...
Yeah, it causes lasting damage. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What's the difference from your perspective between emotional abuse and, like, verbal abuse?
Yeah, they kind of blend a bit, but emotional... To me, they have tactics to try to undermine the person's confidence, to try to undermine even the person's sense of self. And I think that is just much more of a darker way of harming a person. Verbal is, you know, more the name calling, the taunting, the sarcasm, the bullying style behaviors.
So like,
obviously those two blend, you know.
So like gaslighting is more emotional?
I think gaslighting is more emotional, yeah, even though obviously they're using verbal tactics.
Yeah.
But I think the whole idea behind gaslighting is more emotional abuse versus just verbal.
And so is sexual abuse under physical abuse in your head?
Well, in my head, it's kind of a mixture of all of that. I mean, obviously, it's definitely physical abuse because of what they're doing. But, you know, they are usually... often charming the person that they are abusing. They are manipulating the person they're abusing. So I think it pulls in the three major categories, emotional, verbal, and physical.
You know, oftentimes Brendan and I work on the same case, and it's interesting because I won't say my thoughts right away psychologically about a family or whatever we're called in to see. It's usually the kid that we're seeing, the child. And then over time, I will show people who the real patient is, the identified patient, because the patient that's being brought to us is usually not the patient. And over mm-hmm. time, we end up seeing that identified patient is also the abuser of that whole system. Do you find that to be the case?
You know, I don't see those kinds of cases, so I don't have much to offer with regard to that. That's very interesting, though.
But how do you detect an abuser? Like, how would we help our listeners understand if they're dating somebody, if they're being, you know, or if they're setting themselves up, or if they're already in a relationship that feels abusive?
Right. Well, there's some signs, obviously, you know, for example, people who are very controlling, they need to sort of be in charge of everything. They are very possessive of their partner. They themselves need a great deal of attention. You try your best, let's say, to reason with the person, and you find reasoning tends never to work. They're blame shifters. Then there's this often they have this incredible lack of empathy because their focus is so much on themselves and on their own comfort. So they'll violate people just because the lack of empathy is present. They don't appreciate their partners. Again, the manipulation I talked about before. You mentioned gaslighting. That tends to happen quite a bit because they want to alter their partner's reality. And then they themselves, quite often, abusers have this fear of abandonment. So they're constantly trying to control the relationship so that the partner doesn't go anywhere. So those are some signs that I've seen with people who are emotionally, verbal, or physically abusive.
Yeah, I mean, I see that all the time, Brendan. I'm sure you do, too.
No, and something else that I just I wanted to mention is that the hesitance to actually acknowledge and call something abuse. There are any number of reasons why people avoid it and don't want to say it and don't want to attach the stigma to it. The concept, and this has come out a lot, especially over the past couple of days with Harvey, the former head or the still head of Miramax and Weinstein Pictures, and we're in LA, so we're surrounded by that. But for decades, this incredibly powerful man in Hollywood has been sexually harassing, emotionally and verbally abusing and sexually abusing women. And everybody who worked with him, everybody who worked for him was aware of it. And he's paid millions of dollars. His company has paid millions of dollars to get him out of it. And it only just now, because the New York Times published a huge piece on it, has it come out. And the number of times where, and even in his apology, he still is deflecting to this let's wait until all the facts come out. And, you know, the accusations that get put forth where typically, I don't want to say typically men, but typically the more powerful person and the abuser, they are the ones who not only are abusing, but they're the ones who are causing everyone to limit actually calling it abuse and giving it a name. And I'm just wondering, why do you think, is it a snowball rolling down a hill where the abusers then are able to control the whole conversation and the dynamic and even limit the abused from using the word?
I'm not so sure if they would explicitly limit the abuser, I'm sorry, the victim using the word abuse. I think their tactics in how they handle that person, handle the relationship, whatever that relationship might be, will have the person maybe feeling afraid of using that word abuse. So that maybe it's not an explicit, you know, don't call it this, but more that the person feels really afraid of using that word. And on the other side of it, people don't want to feel it. They are the victim of something.
Right. They don't. They're in denial. They don't want to have to make that decision.
Exactly. Yeah.
So do you see a lot of substance abuse weaving in and out of the stuff that you deal with, Dr. Freeman?
In my practice, not so much because I'm in a neurology group. And so our patients are mostly, you know, brain trauma, stroke, PTSD, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I do, when I work on the side with my website, Neuro Instincts, where I do give information about abuse and abusers and that kind of thing, and I hear from people that, yeah, they're dealing with an abuser who's, you know, using substances, and they're trying to figure out, is it the substances or is it their personality style, you know. But those things often go together, you know,
yeah.
As a substance abuse expert.
I want to read you an email we just got. Jason from Dallas, Texas. He's asking, my girlfriend jokes, quote unquote, with me about my weight. Sometimes she is pretty mean and hurtful. She says she's joking, but it feels almost abusive. When I tell her it's hurtful, she tries to laugh it off and not make it a big deal. Any advice? What do you think, Dr. Freeman?
Well, you know, when people really love us, they don't want to intentionally hurt us. The fact that it's being done repeatedly makes you wonder that, you know, is this person demonstrating a style of abuse? And one of the things we have noticed, at least I've noticed at my website, is that excuse of a joke is quite common, that when an abuser is caught in behavior, it's often said, oh, it was just a joke, or you're being too sensitive, or, you know, I didn't mean it, that kind of thing, to kind of not take accountability for the behavior and the pain that it caused. So that style makes you wonder if that is someone who's demonstrating some abusive traits.
Is it safe to say to those that are listening that if it's a repeated pattern of behavior, it's not a joke and it is abuse?
Yeah, I would lean towards that direction, yes. Especially because he voiced that this makes him uncomfortable, and it does more than that, it hurts him.
Right. And I mean, you know, what that then comes to in a relationship issue like this is if he's not what she wants, then she needs to move on. But some people don't, and they'd rather abuse and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, from abuse, from the perspective neurologically, what happens to someone's brain who is a victim of repeated abuse? I mean, does it change?
Wow. That's a huge question, because there is so much that happens in the brain. And it's great that you brought that question up, because some people think that I can stick this out in this relationship, I can handle this, I can handle her, or I can handle him. However, our brain as an organ is going to do what brains do when it's being abused. It's going to operate in a different mode. And people who've gone through extensive abuse, we see this all the time, they operate in what we call a bottom-up state. When that means the limbic system, which is our emotional system of the brain, is more in control than our more reasoning, more balanced frontal lobe area. And the frontal lobes kind of keep the rest of our brain in check, keeps us calm and relaxed. But when the limbic system's out front, you're going to have a very emotional, dysregulated person. And
right.
And I'm sure you may see that a lot with children. They'll start to act out tremendously when they're being abused, because the brain's just not regulated well. People can have concentration problems, significant difficulty reasoning, start having memory trouble. And even though PTSD is looked at often as a psychological condition, you know, it's more of a neurological condition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the symptoms of that. So we see a great deal of PTSD, complex PTSD, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, and then, of course, neurological issues. So, yeah, it has a huge impact, even for the people who decide that, you know what, my abuser doesn't hit me and I'm okay dealing with his or her nasty behaviors. But the thing is, the brain's always going to be responding to it.
Right.
Because the brain does.
Brendan and I, and he can speak to this, we see a lot of teenagers who start abusing mm-hmm. substances because they are in pain and they are self-medicating, but they present as though they have ADD or they have other psychiatric disorders.
Exactly.
And they really don't. They have, you know, the repeated trauma at home.
And
that neurologically, it presents very much like ADHD. Yeah. It really does.
And also they, because of the expectations on high school kids, college kids, to consume fairly large amounts of drugs and alcohol, it segues and slides back and forth where somebody will say, oh, I'm with my friends partying on the weekends, but they're at a party, they're with all of their friends, they're drinking or they're smoking weed or they're taking pills, and they're doing it even in that setting to self-medicate. They're doing it because of the residual trauma from their abuse. They're doing it to try and quiet down those sections of their brain that are responding and have PTSD that you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me a little bit about this trauma bond and cognitive dissonance.
Trauma bonding.
That you talk about.
This is, you know, I know people say this all the time, you know, she was in a bad relationship. Why doesn't she just leave? Just leave. Like, you know, and it's a very logical thing to say. But then when you look at the complexities of the actual relationship, she's trauma bonded to him, almost like how someone would be addicted to a drug. It's very hard to just suddenly say, okay, I'm going to stop this drug and I'll never want it again. When you're trauma bonded, you are deeply connected to that person on a chemical level. And so if they leave or if you leave, you actually go through almost like withdrawal symptoms because the chemistry starts to change a little bit in your brain. And you need that person, not necessarily because you love them, but you need them in order to feel whole. And the cognitive dissonance about the whole thing is that you need somebody who you may not even like, or you need somebody that you know they have horribly bad behaviors.
Yeah.
And you feel you need to be in this relationship with them.
So it's almost like they have to go to rehab for it. They have to withdraw.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wish that there were some place like that for certain, you know, relationships, because the brain of a victim, it actually acts against her when she's going through the breakup period of the relationship, because all the signs in the brain are saying, whoa, we've got to go back and get that connection. The logic part isn't operating. It's more the limbic system saying that.
Right.
The logic part is taking a back seat. And for some women, they can't resist that, or some men, of course, can't resist those urges, and they do go back. And for some, it can be incredibly horrible consequences for going back.
And what about cognitive dissonance? What does that actually refer to specifically?
In different relationships, it means different things. It could be that, you know, the mate demonstrates different behaviors. You know, sometimes they can be unbelievably amazing, and then sometimes they can be cruel. You know, and you have these two different sets of emotions and ideas about this person, and you're trying to blend those two different thoughts about this person, that this person's good or this person's bad. You can't quite figure it out. And so sometimes for people to resolve their cognitive dissonance, you'll start hearing them rationalize. You know, you'll hear them saying, well, no, he's not a bad guy all the time. Or, oh, that's just, you know, his personality. He's a little upset. Or maybe he had a bad day. They'll start rationalizing really bad behaviors to try to normalize it in order to resolve their own cognitive dissonance, this conflict they have in their mind about this person.
And is that a process they go through till they get to a place where they're done?
Yeah, for some people it is. It's that, you know, they decide I'm going to stay with this person, and they'll kind of ignore the bad behaviors. They'll tolerate the taunting. They'll tolerate the incredible pain. So, yeah, they get themselves through that process. But sometimes the abuse starts to ramp up. And when it does, then they're back in that same position again.
Right.
You know, wait a minute. How can I now rationalize this?
Right, because the perpetrator feels the pullback and they're getting, you know, healthier and maybe not in the trap any longer or as much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's just a circle.
So how do we tell someone who's being abused to be, how can they be as mentally healthy and make the right decisions as best as possible in the situation like that?
Right. They're in a tough position. You know, I absolutely think they're in the toughest position. When you're still in it, you know that you probably need to leave, because at that time, you're not in the healthiest place from a cognitive standpoint, from a neurological standpoint, from the brain standpoint,
right,
to take those steps forward, because you probably are bonded to this person. And maybe for a few days you can leave, but sometimes then that's when the chemistry starts to ramp up and you get these cravings and these yearnings, and you need to just talk to the person again or see the person again, and it becomes a mess. It's very difficult. This is why, you know, people need a therapist trained in this area to kind of help them through the process initially,
right,
rather than just trying to go with cold turkey on their own, especially if they have a dangerous partner.
Right. I mean, that's where I would ask Brendan. I mean, that's where substances probably start to enter, when people need to feel better, when the chemicals start to shift.
It goes along with the entire conversation about self-medicating, and you're self-medicating a lot of the causes, and the alcohol and the drug consumption is normally a symptom of that, and then after prolonged use, it can itself become the cause. The immediate response, and culturally it is our default setting, is you have a hard day, you're stressed out about something, you're going to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be applied to, my relationship is terrible, my relationship is abusive, I'm going to go out with my other friends and drink too much, I'm going to drink when I'm at home as a way to try and process and work through this. And it's the, on the surface, it's the most acceptable and easiest way to address it, when in actuality it tends to just create another issue and another situation of abuse.
Absolutely.
So,
and at the time when the chemistry is already out of sync and not operating properly, and the frontal lobes aren't operating properly, that's the worst time to use substances.
So tell me something, though, both of you, what would you tell our listeners if they're in an abusive situation, they start to abuse substances or use substances, what do they deal with first? Do they start to, you know, take away the self-medication, then they still feel the pain? Do they try to address the pain while they're under the influence? I mean, what do you do?
Wow.
I would always, and I do always say, you need to begin by addressing the underlying issues. And in an instance like this, and what we've been discussing, the underlying issue is the abuse and the relationship that is causing the abuse and where the abuse is generating from. And if you can get somebody while they're addressing that to also take 10 to 14 days off from whatever they've been using, whatever substance they've been using, that's great. But unless you address the cause and that root abuse, then you aren't really going to have any avenue to address the substance abuse that's going along with it.
Yeah, exactly.
You agree?
Yeah, I do agree, because there's no real healing when you're in the relationship, when you're in the abusive relationship. It's so difficult for them to even feel themselves in any normal capacity when they're going through abuse every day. They don't know if they're going to walk through the door and what's you know, what they're going to find.
Right.
So it is better to be in a safe situation and away from that partner that's doing this, and then it'll be a lot easier to address all the other issues. It's going to be painful no matter what, at least the safety factor is there, and if that relationship has been terminated.
See, and that's the thing. I think that we have to really, people need to understand that as they start to peel away and break away from their perpetrator, it's painful no matter what. Whether you're on substances or you're not, that's the time to maybe start the first step and go see a psychiatrist who can medicate if needed, so that you can then get off the substances, do it under supervision. You also have a mandated reporter and a confidential relationship to start to unload and work through things, and then deal with the rest of it. That's what I think. So,
yeah, I agree.
Dr. Rhonda Freeman, thank you so much for your time and your expertise. Where can we find out more about you and your work?
Oh, thank you. Well, I have a website for people who were abused, and it's called Neuro Instincts. And so it takes a very brain-related approach to the concept of abuse.
Very
nice. We talk about the who abuses Anne, a victim. And then I'm in private practice at Sunrise Medical Group Neurology in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Got it. It has to be called Sunrise down there.
Yeah, of course.
What are we going to call it in L.A.? Sunset.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Ellie, thank you.
Take
You're
care.
Welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Brendan, that leaves just us alone again.
I was going to make an off-color remark about whatever you're going to call that neurological
phenomenal.
Neurological center in Los Angeles. I'm not going to go there. Yes, we will stay with Sunset.
Yes. So, what do you think?
I've been in emotionally abusive relationships. I've been in relationships that were entirely predicated and dependent upon substance abuse. The real way that it gets better and the real genuine healing occurs with a combination of talk therapy, honesty with yourself, honesty with the people in your life, and eventually removing the source of abuse.
Right. But
It's tough. It's incredibly tough. Difficult. And it's why every single one of us and every person you know, if they're not currently in some type of abusive relationship anywhere on that sliding scale, they have been in the past,
right,
or they will be in the future.
Right. So the key is really know who you're dating, know who you're getting into a relationship with. I think looking at how they treat their parents, how their parents treat them, what their relationships are like in their family, that's kind of what's going to give you a forecast.
Well, you brought up a really good point. In that I specifically, and I know for you it's a bit broader, but I get called in and I get referred to people, and the first thing is my kid has a problem with drugs and alcohol.
Right.
And after a half an hour or 45 minutes of just speaking with the parents without even meeting with the kid or the patient or the person in their 20s, it's immediately addressable as my kid has a problem, period. And it's manifesting in their consumption and their use of drugs and alcohol.
Right.
And
right.
The problem is
me,
the dynamic with the parents.
Right. Instead of them saying to you, my son has or daughter has a problem with substances, you should say back to them, no, they have a problem with you and
well,
use substances.
Right. And normally I do say that. And I know that you and I do say some variation of that on a very regular basis.
But then we get put out.
That's the rub.
Then they all call back.
Everybody always comes back.
Yes, because they run around that circle and they see like, oh, it's not getting any better.
And they'll go to other practitioners and people who work and other mental health care professionals who don't necessarily address it with the forthright approach that I think you've come to be known and loved for.
And hated.
Yes.
That's okay. It gets people better.
That's the only important thing.
Thank you for your time today and your expertise.
My pleasure. Thank
You'll
you for
be
having
back.
Me.
So where can we find you?
Right now, should I just give out my personal cell phone number?
Yeah, please.
Right now, at this point in time, as I am still a man of mystery, the next time I'll be here, the next time I come in here, I will have at least one direct route to locate me.
Okay. Until then, they can find you through me.
That's it. That's
I'm
the
here.
Only way.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure again.
So that was our podcast. Good experts, lots of good information about abuse, what it is, how to get rid of it, substance abuse, the weaving of that together. It's a nasty world, but I know a lot of people are in it, and it has to be dealt with. Otherwise, it only gets worse. So I think there's four very important points for you and all of us to take away today. Number one is knowing the stereotypes of abuse. There's different kinds of abuse. There's physical, there's emotional, there's verbal, there's sexual, there's intellectual, all different kinds of abuse. And yes, they intermingle with each other, where there's physical and sexual and emotional and verbal. But overall, you're trying to identify the type of abuse that it is originating from. So it's emotional, really, but it's done through a verbal mechanism, because that helps the treatment specificity and it helps the outcome become better. So there are stereotypes of abuse, and it's best to know them. The second important point I think to take away from here is that what are the signs of an abuser? Like, how do I know, or how do I kind of recognize that if I'm dating somebody, I start to see red flags, or if I'm in a relationship already and I see things or feel things, are they red flags? And the first one is the controlling, possessive nature of someone. If they're really tightly controlling you and they're reacting if you're at the grocery store too long, or they're calling your phone 50 times or texting you or asking you a lot of questions, that's a red flag. The next is the need for attention. Does the abuser or the perpetrator need constant abuse? They need attention from you. They need to know, you know, that you think they're wonderful, that they're good, and they need positive reinforcement at all times. They need reassuring of everything. They are blame shifters. You're going to find yourself in a situation where you know darn well what just happened was either an accident or had nothing to do with you, but somehow it's flipped on to you and the blame is now on you. And so they're really great at blame shifting. Another red flag. And then there's a lack of empathy where they really don't have the feeling and reaction to something that they should have. So like if someone gets hurt or you say, ow, that punch hurt, even though they say it was a joke, it's not a joke and it hurt, but they don't have the empathy. They don't have the reaction to you saying, you know what, I'm so sorry, that must have hurt. They just kind of laugh because they don't feel empathy. Also, that they don't really respect you and they have no respect, and it comes across in many different ways and in many different venues, whether you're in front of your friends or family or in private, they feel the need to humiliate and embarrass. And then they also have the abuser, the fear of abandonment, which keeps them in this cycle of being needy, of controlling you, because if you're controlled, then you don't leave and then they don't have to deal with their fear of abandonment. So the healthier you get in those kinds of situations, the more you're going to see the fear of abandonment and behavior ramp up. But those are signs that you're on the right track of freedom and healthiness. So go for it. The third tip I think that's really important to see and understand with abuse is that these acts are repeated and they are harmful and hurtful. So for instance, we had an email from a listener who said that his girlfriend tells him that he's overweight and she makes funny jokes. He's told her it hurts him. He is embarrassed. He doesn't like it. He's told her over and over again, and she continues to do it. That is a repeated pattern of behavior that you want to look for in someone who's abusing, because they know it hurts and they keep doing it. And that's, again, that lack of empathy. And then the last tip I think that's important to take away from today is, believe it or not, living in these situations as the abuser, your brain is reacting, just like our brain reacts to anything we do, whether we take a walk or we drive the car. Our brains are moving chemically. They're a live organ, and so they are going to respond to trauma in very different ways, and it changes your brain chemistry. And it actually, you know, we heard today from Dr. Freeman that it will flip the apparatus in your brain, which means that typically we work our brains in our lives through thinking from our frontal lobes, and our brain activity is just, you know, the way it is, and we don't have emotions as the first response to things. But in a traumatic brain that has been exposed to a lot of abuse, that flips. And then our first response comes from our emotional side of our brain, which then doesn't allow our cognitive side to kick in and us to think through things. We're just emotionally reacting. And that's what a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder is like. So understanding all of these things and the effects on our body and our brain should make anybody who sees any of these red flags to please jump on them and get some help. And the help is there to get, just sometimes people don't really know where to go to get it. Best place to start is with a psychiatrist. See if there's medication you can get on to help your brain chemistry regulate itself and get your brain back in the way it should be, reflipped, and being able to use your brain to think through things more than emotionally respond, and then start to make a plan to get yourself safe or your family safe or whatever it is. But that's really the best place to start. Get some medication. Don't get on street drugs, because that's oftentimes, as we heard from Brendan, the initial phase where substances on the street, alcohol, drugs, make their entrance to self-medicate someone as they start to pull back and get healthy. Get healthy with a doctor and a plan, and that's the best way to get to the other side. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you for all of our guest experts today. Both of you guys, lots of good information for our listeners. Any callers today, I thank you. Podcasts are always available on my website, on iTunes, and on my little website, www.drsophie.com. Phone app is also available in iTunes. Go get it. It's free. My voicemail is always there for you, 1-855-767-4966. My book is there if you need it. It's the Side-by-Side, the Revolutionary Mother-Daughter Program for Conflict-Free Communication. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook, and you'll know where I am at. Visit iTunes to download the full version of Andy Grammer's Keep Your Head Up. And the most important thing is, don't forget to sweep. Thanks.